Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome back. This is Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center, and we're sitting in Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and I am just so excited because not only one of the greatest chefs in the world is with me today, but one of my dearest friends.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Danielle Boulou.
So nice to be with you here in Brooklyn.
All right. If any of you have been Rip Van Winkling it, like sleeping the last 20 years, and might not know who Danielle is, he is, you know, you can't get more awards than Danielle. You know, you start with the 3 Michelin stars, the 4 stars always again and again from the New York Times, in the top 10 restaurants in the world by the International Herald Tribune, Gourmet's Top Table Award, the Grand Award from Wine Spectator. You get it. But then personally, he's the Chef of the Year, Bon Appetit, James Beard Award for Best Executive Chef in 1992 when he was at Le Cirque, and then the James Beard Outstanding Chef of the Year in 1994, James Beard's Outstanding Restaurateur in 2006. We can go on. There's nothing left for you to win. But what do you do these days?
I tried to do my job, and there's still many things to win. And I think, to me, winning is having somebody coming for the first time and discovering the restaurant and having them hooked. That's what counts.
Oh.
And even 20 years later, it's still the most wonderful thing when somebody comes for the first time in a restaurant and discover the restaurant. Of course, once they come back, they become more familiar. We become more familiar. And when a customer become a regular, then we definitely won everything.
Is the philosophy of Danielle. It makes him so successful. So we're going to get right back into, because this is your story, right? And we want to know how you got to that, how you evolved to that.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you a question about you were born in France, in Lyon, and grew up there. Were you competitive as a kid?
Very competitive and a little temperamental. And
what is a little temperamental?
Basically, I was difficult to my parents, but I was also difficult to the chef who was trying to make me a good cook.
Oh, the naughty Danielle. I want to hear about this. So how were you difficult? Tell me a story about when you were difficult with your parents. How old were you and what did you do?
Oh, I was certainly from the very early age. We lived on the farm. And, in a farm, you don't have too many toys, but there's so much to play with. Animals, anything. So you do all kind of silly stuff sometimes. And my mother will just run after me all the time to make sure that I wasn't in trouble or, you know, trying to. And, of course,
trouble with the animals, trouble with other boys fighting, trouble with girls taking him in the barn or something like that.
That came a little later after, yeah. But
we'll get into that.
At least, you know, there's always danger in a farm. There's always equipment. There's always things. And so, beside that, I think I was a very good, hardworking son. And supporting them a lot in their work, in their daily work. And but then at 14, I wanted to become a chef, and I left home and live by myself in Lyon. I was living in an uncle's den, which was fine, but I don't think he worried too much about me. And so, you know, at 14, when you're in a city like Lyon, you can have a lot of fun.
His smile is going from ear to ear. You sent Bill Buford to Lyon to work in some of the restaurants that you did.
Well, Bill wanted to go to France. And
well, let's not talk about Bill. This is not, I don't want that. I want to ask, what is the apprentice experience that you remember that you wanted him to get? Not just knowing how to cut Brunoise vegetables, but what are some of the social issues happening in a kitchen?
Well,
that
first,
it's a rite of passage for a 14-year-old.
Absolutely. So the first thing you learn when you're an apprentice is, of course, to do all the crappy stuff the cook or the chef de partie or the sous chef or the chef don't want to do. And but at least I was in a very honorable place where the cooks never did pot washing or dishwashing. The apprentice was strictly for cooking. Many other restaurants used them also to do the cleaning. Mm-hmm. No, that was not part of my education while I was a clean cook as well. But and then soon after, you start to cook for the staff meal. And that's where you can really distinguish yourself, because you get the appreciation of everyone if the meal is good, and you get the support of everyone if the meal is good. Mm. And if you make a very good meal, maybe the waiters who opened that bottle of wine and there was a little bit left over on the bottle will bring you some in the kitchen. Or, you know, you make friends. You make a lot of friends. And but if you mess up the meal, you have no escape.
Well, you know, would they fire an apprentice?
Yeah, they could. They could. I was supposed to be fired, actually.
Oh, really?
I had a big fight with the chef, but not the owner, the chef owner, but the chef.
How old were
because
you?
Because I was 16 and a half, 17, and I had done my apprenticeship, my 3 years. I was 17. I had done my 3 years, and when I passed my exam, which was the exam after 3 years, the apprenticeship exam.
CAP?
CAP. We were about 180 apprentices in Lyon that day, or that 2 or 3 days time, that week of exam, and I was in the top 10. So from that, you get qualified for Meilleur Apprenti de France.
Ah.
And so the Meilleur Apprenti de France, you have to do, and that's when...
The best apprentice.
Yes, and okay. That's when, for the first time, I had my name in the paper as a chef.
Oh my God.
As a cook, as an apprentice, actually.
What did your parents
think? They were proud of me. But the problem is then I didn't like too much the chef I was working for. And now I'm qualified to do the regional competition in order to go to Paris and do the national. Mm-hmm. And I had a big fight with the chef, and he was trying to get rid of me because I was maybe too much arguing too much with him. And he didn't want to train me for my regional. He refused to train me. And so I didn't want to go because I needed to have the training to do it.
What were you arguing with your chef about?
Because...
What kind of things that he gave you?
I mean, one time,
terrible work.
One time, I don't know what I did. I must have told him to go get lost, and he ran after me around the stove. We had the central stove, and he ran after me with a ladle, with a ladle, trying to beat me. And I went around two run, and I run into the dining room, out of the kitchen, and I bump into the owner, chef owner, and he catch me. He put me behind him and stopped the chef. And then after we had a conversation, and after that, and that's a problem, is then after that, the chef de cuisine wanted to fire me, and the chef owner liked me too much and didn't want to fire me, and told the chef, cool off, leave this kid alone, and let him work. And that's when the chef de cuisine didn't want to train me after that, because he was offended. And you know,
so how long did you stay in
that? He didn't have the full power.
So how long did you stay in that restaurant? And
another 6 months, about. And then after my apprenticeship was done. And move on to Georges Blanc, from Nandron to Georges Blanc. And
what's your greatest memory of working at Georges Blanc?
Well, I mean, first, the greatest memory in Lyon is that we were next to Les Halles. And every morning I would go with my boss and pick up the crates of food and fish and vegetable and meat And we just had to cross a building with a back alley. With the back alley, I just had to cross a building and get right into the kitchen. So we were carrying everything like that. And Paul Bocuse was there, Alain Chappelle, Trois Gros, in the market every morning. And they will all gather in the little bistro where I will pass by in front and look at them having, you know, little blanc, vin blanc, and a little a little wine and a little tripe dish. Or
at 5 in the morning?
No, it was about 7:30.
The wine and the tripe at 7 a.m. Yeah. is fine.
Oh, they got to the market early, but by the time they finish, it's about 7:38.
Yeah. Yeah.
Before they go to work.
And you ever, so, did you ever think you would be such good friends with Paul Bocuse today when you were that young?
Paul always was nice to me as well. I did stage in his places. We had our argument sometime. One time I came and...
You argued with Paul Bocuse?
Well, he argued...
With you?
Well, with me. I was supposed to go and help him because one of the young apprentices got burned. Another one was on vacation. He was short of staff. And where I was working, we always had plenty of apprentices. So my boss sent me to Paul Bocuse. And I had been there before because one night we stopped there and Paul Bocuse gave me a big glass of blanc cassis, a white wine with cassis liquor, just to keep the kid happy in the corner there of the kitchen while I was watching the service, because my boss was having a conversation with Paul Bocuse that night. And but then when I came back, there was a rule at Paul Bocuse where basically you had to go to a specific hairdresser, a specific barber, I will say, not even a hairdresser, a barber, where he will shave your head in a very special way. So that was kind of a crew cut, which was the norm at Paul Bocuse to work in the kitchen.
You needed to do that?
And I had my hair, which was a little too long, and my hair was touching my ears, basically, a little bit over, and it didn't that like that at all. And when I came, I had my sunglasses hanging on my shirts. It was like, I don't know, 11 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock in the morning. And he turned me around and said, go and get a haircut there. And we don't need any sunglasses in the kitchen here. I was like, okay, welcome. Thank you. So I went to get my haircut. I put my sunglasses away. And I came back to the kitchen 2 hours later. And that was it. I was, after that, it didn't bother me. But he just wanted to show discipline and understand. And, you know, when you walk into Paul Bocuse's kitchen, you're not walking into any kitchen.
Right. So tell me, at that age, and you're going to Georges Blanc, which is 3-star Michelin, to Paul Bocuse.
Well, at the time, it was 2-star. And the mother, it's called La Mer Blanc.
Oh, La Mer Blanc.
La Mer Blanc. And... And La Mer Blanc was cooking with us, and there were women in the kitchen there.
Oh.
There were about 3 women in the kitchen, which was a first for me because in Lyon, there were also some women in the kitchen like La Mer Brasier, La Mer Guy, but it wasn't at Nandron. We never had a lady in the kitchen at Nandron. So that was the first time, and it was very interesting because... I could feel the woman's touch.
Tell me about that.
Well, it was a lady called Marie, and she worked with the first Mère Blanc, and then with the second Mère Blanc.
Wait,
which was
Mère
the mother
Blanc
of Georges.
Mère Blanc means mother Blanc. So how can there be two mothers of Georges Blanc?
Well, because it was originally started by the grandmother of
Georges
Blanc.
Oh, the grandmother. Okay.
And then the son married a woman who became also La Mer Blanc. She was the daughter-in-law, but she was a good cook too.
I see.
And so that was, and Georges was the third generation, but he was not a girl. So, but I was there at Georges Blanc when he was 28 years old and taking over the restaurant. And
so he was the chef.
He was the chef there.
And so what was the woman's touch? What did you see there that you thought was
the woman's touch? Is then they knew the specialty so well, such as the crepe venassienne. The crepe venassienne is a potato crepe. It's a small potato pancake where it's made with you make a mashed potato, but with no butter inside and just milk. And then you finish it with eggs and flour. and milk, like almost like a crepe batter, but with potatoes inside, mashed potato. And it's all about the temperature of the batter. It's all about the batter who has rested. It's all about the thickness of the batter. It's all about the movement of the spoon into the pan. And it's all about the clarified butter, what temperature it is, and how you pour the batter into to have this perfect crepe with a perfect ring of crunchiness around and very moist inside. And Marie was the only lady who was in charge of making the batter. So nobody knew how to make the batter. And if Marie was not there, they had to call La Mer Blanc to make the batter, but nobody was in charge of touching that batter. And it was basically, I spent 2 years there. I never made the batter. I could play to try to make the
crepe. But do you think if a man made the batter, it would? There's a gender difference in the way a male would does something and a female does something? Or do you think it was just her personally? That
I think there was a little bit of that. I think she had, I mean, it was something was passed from the grandmother to the mother, and pass on to Mary, who was in charge of that. And I think it was the importance that the restaurant had 4 specialty or 5 specialty, and those could not change a bit. And by having somebody else doing the batter, by having too many people touching that batter, it would have changed totally the consistency of the work. And she knew that when potatoes were in the summer, they were different than the winter and all that. So
she
knew how to play
with
that.
Is this the guy who did the creme brulee at Le Cirque?
Exactement.
It's not a gender thing. We're going to have to take a break, and we're going to come back in a minute, and we're going to get on to your life as a chef.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story. I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and you're listening on heritageradionetwork.org. And what .org means is we need your money. But what we want is your support. And to support us, you should become a member. I understand there are 3 million people worldwide that listen to this network. And I said some things to David Chang, like with his colorful language, he even can come on this show. This show and this network really allows us to talk about things without having to worry about sponsorships and commercial interest. And so if you like this network, you like this show, please become a member. Go to Heritage Radio Network.org. And can you believe it? We get the best and the brightest. I don't care, you know, the biggest radio network in the world can't draw bigger talent than Danielle Ballou. Danielle, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Okay,
and,
so you're
and it's so cool to be here in Bushwick, and it feels like we're out on the set of MASH with the tiki bar behind and that little makeshift container radio station. It's cool. It is
like an army outpost.
Yes,
you know, the guy
completely.
Who built this, you know, used to be in Iraq and he used to build advanced
cool.
places, you know. So definitely come out to Roberta's. But I can't believe that, you know, you, as a young chef, you took Paul Bocuse on. But we're going to coming to America. Let's play the Eddie Murphy thing.
Right.
What brought you to America, coming to America? Because you took it by storm.
Well, I think what first brought me to America was the fact that I worked with some American in France, few chefs, and all the chefs in France during the 70s, they were all traveling to America. And the story, Michel Gérard was here in New York with Régine, the club, and I was working with many chefs, young chefs who worked for Michel Gérard. And I worked myself at Michel Gérard, and I was listening to their stories in New York, and then I said, God, I got to go and travel to America one day. And before that, I went to Denmark. Roger Verger, a great chef I worked for, sent me to Denmark for a couple of years there. And one day, the opportunity came then in Washington, D.C., in a private home of the ambassador of the European Economic Community, was a job for a young chef. And I took the job and came to Washington, D.C. in 1980. And after 2 years in D.C., what fascinated me is that I could see that there were a shift in generation and shift in style of cooking, because you had the very classic French restaurant there in D.C., and so was in New York. And then there were guys like Jean-Louis Paladin, who was the renegade. He was the new generation. He was the youngest chef in France to get 2 stars at the age of 28. In Condon, in the southwest of France. And when Jean-Louis came to America at the Watergate, he just revolutionized the aspect of what is a French restaurant. And he also started right away to get so involved with the local farmers. And he would have friends who were lawyers and had the farm in the country and say, why don't you raise me squab? And why don't you raise me this? And he went to Maine with, at the time, Rod Mitchell, and tried to really dig into having Rod finding him lamprey and finding him eels and baby eels and diving for scallops.
He was recreating what you would do in France.
Having divers going for scallops, day boat scallop rather than dragging.
And do you think he was the father of that whole movement?
Jean-Louis was so involved in the ingredient. And then every day he will write his menu every day. He took calligraphy calligraphy class. And he will write the menu himself every day. And the menu will be a 6, 8, 10 course menu. And you'll never know what you eat at Jean-Louis.
But now we're talking about you.
We
remember Jean-Louis.
Yeah,
well.
It was the click, because
it was the click.
When I saw what he did there, I said, well, I think I should stay in this country and be part of it.
Really?
And then I wanted to come to New York, and I asked Jean-Louis, I say, you know, I really want to get out of Washington. I want to go to New York. He said, go to the Westbury. That was the same management as the Watergate Hotel.
Uh-huh.
And he sent me to the Westbury at the Polo Lounge. And that's where, again, I met back Roger Verger, who was sending another chef from France there, Patrice Boilly. And I started at the Polo Lounge in New York. And from there, I never, ever questioned, when my daughter was born, where I wanted to go back to Lyon at that time. I never questioned, and I could not be the chef I wanted to be because I'm in New York.
Wow. So there were a lot of interesting young Americans in that kitchen at the Westbury. Who was there that we might know?
Well, there's a guy named TK for the intimate, and that's Thomas Keller. And there was, actually a farmer who come to the farmer's market, Bradley Brad. We used to call him Brad Bradley, who has a wonderful farm upstate New York, who worked with David Boulay as well for a long time. And Brad was one of the chefs de partie. And then there was, of course, Alfred Portal. There was Bill Yosses. They were
unbelievable at the West.
Frank Crispo and many other chefs. At the Westbury, I mean, you're talking 1983.
Right. So did they cook differently than your contemporaries in France when you looked at them? Did they have the techniques down, or did you say these Americans have to come along before?
No. They were very, I mean, they were very good cooks. I mean, we could really count on them. They were, I mean, a commitment beyond, it was really a commitment beyond expectation. And for me, everybody was so driven to learn, but so driven to accomplish as well. And that was also in the mid-80s, I think, was a very fun time in New York, because they were the beginning of some emerging American chef doing some, I mean, jam open on the Upper West Side with Jonathan Waxman. And the cooking he was bringing had a little bit of French, had a little bit of Provence, but a little bit of Italy. It was a little bit like Roberta's today here. Was jams in the 80s there.
Right, the energy. And,
yeah,
and
but it was about
breaking
the organic,
down. Yeah.
The organic chicken cooked in a in a wood fire, and about the grill, a lot of things grilled, but delicious,
so
very market-driven.
You know, you're famous. You're famous for going out and eating. Like, nobody can believe how much you can eat. And so, you know, you visit all these restaurants.
I'm getting better.
But tell me what it was like to go out in the 80s after service.
And it was fun.
Like, and what was it? What is it like today? Has it changed at all? I mean, I knew you in the 80s. And
I mean, of course, they were always happening and happening around new places. They were always new chefs, new places. But maybe I don't think we had the full diversification of talent we have today, because all of those young chefs who came from any background, ethnic background, suddenly now start to own their own restaurant, like in Danji, the young chef.
Hoonim Kim, Hooni. He's a graduate of our school.
Right,
yeah,
of
he
your
just
school.
Got outstanding came, graduate. Yeah.
He came to work for me.
Oh, did he?
And, yeah, of course, he worked with us. And many young chefs like him who, I mean, had a serious sort of classical training with your school, with us, with my school. And
Restaurant Dernière L'École.
Voilà. And now is doing a pseudo-Korean, American, maybe with a certainly a some
Django.
Yes, a touch of French.
Yeah.
And it's very, I think it's very interesting to see all these things.
That's true, that they take their background.
Mushrooming everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah. Much more ethnic.
And it's a movement which is not only local, but it's really national. And so it's the result of 3 decades of chefs who have cross-trained themselves. Mm-hmm. And now we can really see in those 3 decades, the new one are coming with even a greater definition of what they want to do, and a greater variation in what is offered today in style of cooking. From even within the French repertoire itself, there is a big array of style within the French restaurants.
When someone takes you to a new restaurant, what makes you smile? What, you know, when you sit down, what are the things that you, you know, you just like
in a brand new place,
brand new, or something like Roberta's. Like, if you've never been here, what are the kinds of things that you look for in a restaurant?
Well, I just had before you came in, and we started the show.
Have you been here before?
Oh yes, I took my parents here. My father is 85, and I built him at home a wood fire. He has a wood oven where he bake his bread inside, and we bake dishes, we bake gigot, we bake all kind of things. And so he spent half of the lunch in front of the oven, front of the guys working, to try to see what they were putting in this oven there at Roberta. And then he came back home and was inspired to do pizza.
Oh, wow, that's
summer.
Great. So
you see, I mean,
So what do you look for in a restaurant when you're a consumer?
I think what I look for is the genuine soul of the place. Of course, I'm looking forward to taste the food. I'm looking forward to have a very fresh, delicate. I'm not always looking for technical part of the cooking, but more the genuine, genuine pleasure of eating. And the genuine pleasure of eating comes from very simple things. I just had a pizza, is the white and green, where it's basically the mozzarella with some parmesan and some lemon oil, and finish with a bunch of freshly picked greens from the market, and there's some bitter and there's some spicy greens a little bit, and just a shave of pecorino on top, and it was just delicious. This sort of warm, baked, gooey and crunchy greens on top, so simple and so delicious.
It's so delicious.
And I think that's what I'm looking for in food. Of course, then it's not the definition of Restaurant Daniel, simple and delicious. Delicious it is, simple not always. But at the same time, we can take also cuisine to another dimension. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is haute cuisine. And mm-hmm. haute cuisine, of course, it takes a lot of experience. It takes a lot of it takes talent. I think it's easier for a chef to step down and become more casual. It's very difficult for a casual chef who has only worked in casual places to become a master chef.
What does it take to become a master chef? What are the steps in between?
Well, the step in between is the mentor who's going to teach you how to become a master chef. And I think if you don't have those mentors, you become autodidact, which is cool. It's interesting. It has an angle. It's sometimes very interesting. I mean, there's many of the great chefs of the world, not many, but some great chefs of the world didn't have a mentor. They wanted to be, they knew what they wanted to do, and they were doing it their way, and they were doing it very well. And I believe in that. It's just they are a little bit more rare than the one who has a good mentor.
Are you saying that some chefs, and you're using the word casual, but some chefs could be more one-dimensional or two-dimensional, but to be a master, you really have to have a lot of dimensions to you and complexity and mastery. And
well,
then
I think
you could do some complex dishes. And
very much, but I think you see, for example, then there's many young chefs who have casual restaurants. I mean, David Chang, for example, as an example. And I think many of those young chefs today, if that wasn't for who they worked and how they learned to cook and how they learned to manage a kitchen and how to learn to create dishes in a very maybe structured way, mm-hmm. Maybe they would have not been able to succeed the same way.
Right.
And
can you see, David Chang graduated from French Culinary.
Congratulations.
Can you see? No, yeah, right.
You have made a good one there.
Yeah, we made a good one. Hey, we had three, Dan Barber, David Chang, and Wiley all won Monday night. We're very proud. Can you see his technique, French technique, even in his sambar and noodle bar?
I think because for example, with the pork shoulder, mm-hmm. I mean the technique of the slow baking, the slow cooking of it, definitely came from also the technology who help us reach some more precision in the cooking as well, mm-hmm. and this technology has often at the beginning was developed in France, mm-hmm. and used in France, and then after of course it started to seep everywhere, and today there's some of the most interesting technological tools made here in America who are making their way to France because they don't have it anymore.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so we're
and so I think for David, what I want to say is then his broad knowledge of cooking can take him back to his roots, mm-hmm. with maybe a bigger dimension, I mm-hmm. would say.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have to take another break, and we'll be back and talk some more.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
We like these little breaks. Danielle and I are riffing, and you know, we almost forgot to come back on air here. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, and remember, it's membership drive. I'm not going to ask you for money again, but just go and become a member, and I'll be happy with you. You know, I'll buy you a coffee.
This is the most interesting radio in America because only talk about food, and I think people are so generous when it comes to food, and
We're taking that quote. We're putting it on the website, Danielle.
Absolutely. So please send your money.
Good. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So getting back here, you know, we're not going to do the standard thing asking you your timeline history. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to go right to today. And you've done it all. As far as any chef in the world, you've won all the accolades. You've opened many different kinds of restaurants. You're on how many continents? You're in Asia, Europe, United, you know, in here, Canada. What, you know, and you're young. You got 30 more good years in you.
Yes,
I so, hope. You know, like young chefs dream in 5 years, I want to do this. I don't want to say you're an old chef, but you've just done
I'm
everything
mature.
We know.
I am mature.
A mature chef. You've done everything we know in the known world. What is it in 5 years?
I don't think I've done everything.
Okay, what haven't you done that still is still something interesting for you to do?
And I'm bugging my partners and all that. I mean, I was born and raised on the farm.
Mm.
And I will dream to go back to the farm or at least have a farm myself here. And I'm kind of a late bloomer in the movement. But at the same time, one day it could happen. And that's something I would like to do. And it become a retreat, not for me only, but for all my chefs who work for me in New York,
right,
where they have a place to go on Sunday and we can share moments together there in a very different way than, you know, I mean, everybody, we when we're at work, we don't have enough time to share moments. Mm-hmm. We are there to fulfill our duties and make sure that we are well organized with it and we are doing a lot of plannings and a lot of and then every day, the service, the you know, the organization, the preparation, the service, and we never find enough time in our life to have reflection and to be able to, as a communal group, to get together. So I hope that if I can realize that, I will be very happy.
Can you share with the public out there how a restaurant becomes a family?
Well, interestingly enough, you know, is the way you treat your staff, the way you respect them, the way you value them, and the way you give them a chance to feel secure and feel motivated, of course, compensated. But the family, the real sense of family. For example, at Danielle, we have so many couples who were created on the lines where
they work together.
They work together. They became a couple. They had children, and that is since I've been here for the last three decades. I have so many baby Danielle running around.
A lot of godchildren there.
Godchildren. But there's also, for example, I have an example of Bernard Vraud, where Bernard has been with me at Le Cirque for 6 years, and for the last 20 years at Daniel, 25 years together, and his wife, Ginette, is... So Bernard is the a manager, dining room manager, assistant, and Ginette is the... we call her the gouvernante, where she's in charge of all the maintenance and the cleaning in the morning, and you know, the ladies' touch when it comes to really keep the place pristine and beautiful. And then his son is also a maître d' at Daniel, Yannick, and his brother-in-law, Gioviani, is also a maître d' at Daniel, and his sister, Bernard's sister, is the co-check at Daniel. And so we have, within the same family, we have five people working in the same place.
Wow.
And it's the example of many couples who are working at Daniel. And many of them are more than 10 years with me, 15 years. And so it's really rewarding because it feels like a family. And people come to the restaurant, not only for me, but for the family as well.
So there are a few chefs in your, I would say, category of chef, multiple restaurants. How many people, thousands of people work for you right now?
700 and, I don't know, maybe 40, 50 right now in New York, and then about 1,300, yeah, total.
Okay, so 2,000 people now work for the Dynex Group, which is your
less,
guys.
Less than 1,500, but
less
about
of,
that,
okay,
yeah.
So that... I know that many chefs have had to do the jump to being a business person, but you are one chef that I still feel is a chef. You know, you're still cooking. I go to Danielle and you're in the kitchen. I can't believe it. And you just, you know, so how do you balance your time? And how do you like that business hat? You know, do you like having all these restaurants?
I enjoy having all these restaurants. I enjoy sharing the responsibility of managing those restaurants with everyone. I mean, of course, we have a structure of management where I always sit and in the pyramid, there is at least 5 levels above me and there is 20 levels below me. But I am kind of floating in between. And those 5 levels above me, they are the CFO, the COO, the director of operation, director of HR, director of PR, director of purchasing. I mean, you know, we have all these layers of amazing, dedicated, very professional, very loyal partner with me who are managing every managers, every chef. We have the corporate chef, of course. I wish I could name them all by name, but it will take too long.
No, and you're wonderfully mentoring them because they're regularly up for Beard Awards as being best
very
in their
much.
Category.
I mean, I
so you're
say,
a mentor as well. You're an educator as well.
For example, Jean-François Bruel at Daniel, who has been with me for 14 years. And the first time I gave him the job at DB Bistro to be the chef at DB Bistro, a year later he won Rising Star Chef, James Beard, in Rising Star Chef in America. And then Andrew Carmelini, I gave him the Café Boulle position as a chef de cuisine, his first position as chef de cuisine. And a year later he won Rising Star Chef.
Give me the job, I'll be rising.
Then I hire Gavin Kaysen. We didn't come out of the... Usually we do a lot of promotion within, and we basically farm them out and we raise them and we promote them. And many of my chefs is their first job as chef in a new restaurant, for example. And Gavin Kaysen was the case, like Andrew Carmelini, where I decided to take him from the outside and bring him in. Because they already had a very good background and I felt that we could do well together. And when Gavin took over Café Boulle, a year later, he was Rising Star Chef.
How do you mentor? How do you mentor guys like that? You know, when they're at that level, how do you bring them to the next level?
I think is the trust you give them and the freedom you give them help them, of course, a lot being comfortable with the program. If I were to impose everything on every one of my chefs, I think they will feel too locked up and too maybe unmotivated to participate in their program as much as my program. So mentoring is, of course, when you have a young chef who start as a young cook coming out of the French Culinary Institute and becoming now a cook after 2 years, 3 years with us, we make sure that they move around and they work with every stations and work with different chef de partie and different sous chef. And that's part of their education. And then maybe we move them from one restaurant to another.
Let me ask you something, because I understand a number of kitchens, this is a live show, they play it in the kitchen while they're prepping, you know, for lunch or over the lunch.
Yes, absolutely.
How long does it take? How many years should somebody put in going to great restaurants to learn before they go out on their own and try to do a restaurant?
Well, I think today, I will say that it will take 10 years. 10 years of loyal and dedicated service to a good mentor, or few good mentors. And I think if somebody put 10 good years in the right place, I'm sure that it will pop out as being a future leader.
Thank you for saying that, because the dimensions don't come overnight.
No, absolutely not.
And they're not something that can just be learnt and replicated right away.
Yeah,
I think that's.
And that's why, for me, I mean, I started at 14, and at the age of 21, Roger Verger sent me to Copenhagen to represent him to do his cuisine there. In a hotel who was a Tradition et Qualité, a very hotel plaza in Copenhagen. And I was a mature and well-trained chef. But after a year and a half, I had already done 3 amazing restaurants in my career, and I was only 21. And I felt that I was missing something. And I decided to go back to France and go to Michel Gérard to have one more experience in a 3-star. And then after, I came back and I was so much stronger. So it's good sometimes to test the water and then know how to step back, step down a little bit, keep learning and step up again.
You know, we only have a minute left. What if you?
But
had...
I would like to say that for anyone who is, a lot of people are passionate about what we do and a lot of people would like sometime to dream to become a chef. And I think if they buy the book Letter to a Young Chef, which I wrote with Peter Kaminski, who lives nearby here.
He's coming for lunch, by the way.
Oh, yes, very nice. And so I think that will tell them a lot about, you know, the discipline, the drive, and the ambition you have to do that job and the talent.
I think that's perfect. Just keep cooking. Keep
opening
great restaurants and mentoring the great chefs of tomorrow.
Very much.
That's what matters most. We're so happy to have you in America. Now, you are a great American chef.
I'm proud to be here, too.
Okay. I hope you come back.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.